Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the possibility of a reversal in the vexed relationship between the US and Iran after 34 years of hostility and name-calling, and speak with Gary Sick, who served on the National Security Council under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan, and was the principal White House aide for Iran during the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis. He's the author of All Fall Down, America's Tragic Encounter with Iran, and October Surprise, America's Hostages in Iran and the Election of Ronald Reagan. Then we'll look further into the agreement where no one won and no one lost, and where the symbolism outweighs the substance, and speak with anthropologist and Middle East expert William O. Beeman, the author of The Great Satan Versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other. We will discuss how the hawks on both sides have dominated the narrative up until now, and whether the doves on both sides will be able to establish an enduring dialogue. Then finally, we will look into the second day of protests in Thailand and the special security powers invoked by the government to quell the angry response to a controversial political amnesty bill that would allow the brother of the current prime minister, who was ousted, to return from exile without serving jail time for corruption. Gerald Fry, a distinguished professor of international and intercultural education at the University of Minnesota, who has written extensively about Thailand, joins us to discuss the revival of the bitter divisions that led to a military coup in 2006. Joining us now is Gary Sick, a senior research scholar at Columbia University's Middle East Institute and the author of All Fall Down, America's Tragic Encounter with Iran, and October Surprise, America's Hostages in Iran and the Election of Ronald Reagan. He served on the National Security Council under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan, and was the principal White House aide for Iran during the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis. A retired U.S. Navy captain with service in the Persian Gulf, North Africa, and the Mediterranean, he was a deputy director for international affairs at the Ford Foundation from 1982 to 1987, where he was responsible for programs relating to U.S. foreign policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gary Sick.
It's nice to be back with you.
And I imagine, since you were there in the White House in charge of the Iran desk at the National Security Council during the hostage crisis, and you have followed this vexed relationship between the U.S. and Iran for these long 34 years of hostility and name-calling, do you think that there may be a reversal in the trajectory of this relationship?
We have seen a truly monumental shift. Somebody said that the U.S. delegation, starting with Secretary Kerry, John Kerry, Secretary of State, and Wendy Sherman and other members of the delegation, had 30 hours of official conversations with senior Iranian officials during this last 2 weeks of whirlwind negotiations. That is 30 hours of direct talks for the first time in 34 years. We had zero conversations at a high level with Iran for all of the intervening periods. We did have some discussions with them during the period of the Afghan invasion, and other things where Iran tried to be helpful to us, and we stiffed them, basically. But basically, this is a real game changer. And in some respects, I think the situation now is really different than it has been before. It is, you know, now suddenly the United States, if it has a problem with Iran, can actually go and talk to Iran and say, we've got a problem, and let's work it out. And they've got somebody on the other end who will say, okay, I hear what you're saying, let's do it this way. And then they negotiate. That is totally new. So my guess is that having crossed that line, having opened up that relationship, it's never going to go back to where it was before. So I do think that we have really move from one era into another. And from the perspective of somebody like me who's been watching it, I can only say it's about time.
And in terms of how quickly things could turn around, you mentioned the possibility that, well, the availability or access now, you can actually talk to somebody on the other side. Now, there's certainly, beyond the nuclear portfolio, which has taken up most of the attention, For example, the U.S. is in a real bind in Afghanistan in terms of getting out, getting all that equipment out. And the Pakistanis have gouged the U.S. and NATO to get the stuff in there in the first place, and now they're trying to gouge them even more to get the stuff out. And the Russians are not being cooperative at all about getting it through the stands. The Iranians have a very, very new highway, which was built with help from India, all the way down from the Persian Gulf right up into Afghanistan. Any chance of that being used, or is that on the agenda?
Well, I can't say what's really on the agenda because I'm not working on Afghanistan and I'm not privy to the internal communications. But it is a very interesting example of the kinds of things that previously would not even be considered and now suddenly are possibilities. I mean, we have, if you start looking at problems around the Middle East, whether it's Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria, or the Arab-Israel dispute, or Lebanon, if you start examining it, Iran is part of that issue. And in many cases, and the point that you make is a good one, we actually have similar interests with Iran, that they want to maintain stability. They are actually prepared to play a constructive role. Not always. And you know, it's not something you can take for granted. On the other hand, having the opportunity to talk to them about their position and explore those mutual interests is a new world. So having an alternative, when the Pakistanis say, you know, no, we're not going to let you do that and we'll charge you X amount or we will make your life very difficult, having an alternative and say, well, okay, we can do it with the Iranians. Suddenly, the bargaining leverage of the United States goes up. And that's true in a number of issues, even in areas where we disagree with them fundamentally. So it's not that we have to love Iran or that they have to love us, but the fact that they are, that we can now deal with them in a sensible way changes everything and actually makes every issue in the Middle East somewhat different. In most cases, somewhat better than it was before. So I do think, I don't want to overestimate this, and I don't want to pretend that everything is just fine, but I do think that we now have opportunities to work on issues together that are actually, once that gets in the mindset of the people in the White House, that's going to be a very attractive idea.
And again, I'm speaking with Gary Sickers, a senior research scholar at Columbia University's Middle East Institute and the author of All Fall Down, America's Tragic Encounter with Iran, and October Surprise, America's Hostages in Iran and the Election of Ronald Reagan. He served on the National Security Council under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan and was the principal White House aide for Iran during the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis. So what are we to make then of the naysayers out there with obviously people like former Bush administration ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton? It's fairly reflexive, saying the deal is badly skewed and an abject surrender by the United States. Israel's prime minister is saying it's not an historic agreement, but an historic mistake. And, I mean, I suspect these are very much in the minority. Most of what I've been hearing has been pretty positive. And one of the things that seems to be missing in most of this criticism, particularly when a lot of Republican senators are saying that the president somehow the Iranians are cooperating with Obama to save him from embarrassment over the launch of Obamacare. It's sort of taking on a surreal kind of nature. But surely it's worth pointing out, this is the P5 plus one. This is not just America's made a deal with Iran. This is the permanent five at the United Nations plus Germany.
Let me make a couple of points here. First of all, just in passing, remember that just 10 days ago, the Israelis touted them as the great victors and you know, as having saved the day because they came in and, in fact, stopped an agreement that would have taken place then, and by being tough. And President Hollande of France went to Israel and was received with a hero's welcome. Well, this last weekend, the French signed off on the agreement. So the agreement that went in has full French agreement and the German. And, you know, British and Russian and Chinese. So this is not an agreement that is sort of casual or is, you know, the United States doing it for narrow political reasons. The other thing that I'd like to point out is that you remember Netanyahu standing up in front of the UN a year ago and holding up that cartoon of a bomb. And the idea of the bomb was that Iran was accumulating 20% enriched uranium. And the red line was when they crossed that line, they would have enough for a bomb. And that the time period would be so short that it possibly would require military action. Well, look at it today. What the Iranians have agreed to in this agreement is basically to remove the entire bomb. It's not up to the red line. It doesn't exist at all. They're doing away with all of their 20% enriched uranium. And frankly, I think it would have been nice if the Prime Minister of Israel would have acknowledged at least that that had been taken care of, that his, you know, his speech to the UN and all of the points that he made there about the threat to Israel had been removed. Now, that doesn't mean that it's a perfect agreement. It doesn't mean that everything has been taken care of. But to turn this agreement around and say that it is a threat to Israel and a threat to the Middle East is really pretty peculiar. When just a year ago you made a speech saying that the great threat to Israel was this body of 20% enriched uranium, which is now going to disappear in the next 6 months. I think there's something really that, you know, we need to get more serious about where we are. It's very clear that the Israelis and the Saudis would very much like for the United States to keep a gun to the head of Assad in Syria, bomb him if necessary, and the same thing with Iran. Keep your force level up very high and threaten them with military action, but don't get an agreement, because the agreement actually reduces the threat and means that the whole thing may be resolved without military action. Well, if that's your criterion, I think it's a false criterion. And basically, the solving these problems, whether it's the chemical weapons in Syria or the nuclear weapons, the potential of a nuclear bomb in Iran, is very much in the U.S. interest. And I think that Obama's program, his policy on the Middle East, is really to say, we are prepared to do what's necessary to preserve U.S. national interests. And he doesn't say anything in that policy that we're going to go around and threaten, you know, war with other countries on behalf of other countries. And basically, he's looking at U.S. national interests in a very clear and unequivocal way. And I think that's refreshing and actually, I think, should be applauded. So from my perspective, what he's doing is actually serving American national interests extremely well. And that, I think, needs to be pointed out.
And Gary Sick, the French objection to the deal that almost happened and now has happened had a lot to do, my understanding is it had a lot to do with the Arak reactor, which is a heavy water reactor that produces lots of plutonium in the spent fuel. But one of the things that's been missing in the debate is that while the Iranians have agreed to freeze that construction, and my understanding, the subtext was that there was a fear that the Israelis would strike that. That was like the number one on the hit list, and they'd have to do it before it went hot. But my understanding is that the Iranians have no reprocessing of the spent fuel rods, which is a very complicated process. They have no infrastructure for it. So the idea, and you know, one could be definitely justifiably concerned that the Iranians are building a reactor that's identical to the Dimona reactor that produced all of the plutonium for Israel's bombs. But the Israelis have the reprocessing of the fuel rods to extract the plutonium. There's no evidence that Iran has that. So
not only do they not have it, but in this agreement that has just been signed, they formally agree not to build a reprocessing plant. So their argument is they want to use that heavy water reactor to produce isotopes, which are used for medical purposes. That's their argument. The reality is the reactor that they now use to do that is a reactor that the United States gave them back in the old days under the Shah, and which they have been using for medical isotopes, but it's very outdated. And it was actually to keep that one running that they were producing the 20% enriched uranium. So this is all a very circular business. The key problem on all of this, Ian, and what really makes it difficult, is that anything that you do for a peaceful nuclear program actually can have consequences, can actually create the possibility of a military capability. So it is almost impossible to draw a line between those two. And so if you look at a country, and this could be any number of countries, it certainly could be Japan, it could certainly be Brazil or Argentina or other countries who are producing uranium on their own, enriched uranium, basically going about a nuclear program of nuclear development and energy, those same things that they're doing could be used for military purposes. And so in the Iranian case, everything that they do, regardless of what the objective is interpreted as a covert effort to create a bomb. And what the negotiations are about is how do you ensure that those activities that Iran is doing do not turn into a bomb. And right now, we are seeing a case where Iran is actually cooperating with us on that. They're saying, okay, we don't want to build a bomb, and we're prepared to give real assurances, including daily inspections and lots of other intrusive inspections. Iran is the most inspected country in the entire world as far as their nuclear program is concerned. So Iran is saying, we're prepared to cooperate on that. And so I have a hard time understanding the sort of hysteria that says, okay, there's something that they're doing over here that could conceivably in some future state turn into a nuclear weapon. Well, the way to deal with that is through negotiation and say, okay, there's reason to be suspicious about this. Let's give us assurances so that we inspect this as necessary. And in the case of the heavy water reactor, there's no reprocessing. So you cannot build a bomb with that reactor. That's the way to deal with the problem. And the idea that you have to, in effect, eradicate Iran's nuclear program in order to solve the problem is really a recipe for war. It's a recipe that the only way the problem can be resolved is through military action. And that is a very expensive, complicated, and ultimately self-defeating process.
Well, just in closing then, Gary Sick, some people have compared this to Nixon's opening with China. And of course, it's worth remembering that Nixon's opening with China had an awful lot to do with Russia and to triangulate, put the U.S. in the catbird seat, being able to play China off against Russia. Is there any possibility that this deal could put us in the catbird seat in terms of playing off Saudi Arabia? We're reducing our dependence on Middle East oil, but we do have this very, very duplicitous relationship with Saudi Arabia. And, you know, they're behind the radicals in Syria. I can go through the whole list of the Taliban, yeah. Al-Qaeda, you name it. Is there a possibility that there's any broader geopolitical consequences here?
Well, I think when you hear the cries of anguish from Saudi Arabia and also from Israel, part of it is that they're concerned about, they would like to have Iran stay as an enemy behind, you know, a wall and isolated and under the gun. And they don't want to deal with Iran as another, you know, legitimate country in the Middle East. And I think that's really what's going on here, is that because of this opening, because of the discussions that we've had and the negotiation, Iran is now able to play a more normal role in the Middle East. And that does bother some people. With regard to U.S. interests in particular, I think what it does is it reduces the threat in the Middle East overall. So, for instance, after this negotiation, the price of oil went down by 2% just over the weekend. That's money in people's pockets. That's basically, it's good for our economy, actually, and for normal drivers. So there are benefits to be gained from this. And the other one is that the United States, over the last 10 years, has created an extremely extensive array of bases and operating facilities in the Middle East and military forces that are quite expensive. And if the threat level goes down because Iran becomes a more normal country or is dealt with through diplomacy rather than military threats, it means that the cost to the American taxpayer goes down. And that's also a net plus. So there are some real advantages involved in this in terms of U.S. national interests. I must say that a lot of the people who are most offended by this agreement and who are most unhappy about it are very much the same people who really wanted to get us into Iraq and who have been cheerleaders for the Iraq war and all of the costs and everything else that went with that. And I think that needs to be pointed out. I mean, we are avoiding a war by doing a deal with Iran. And indeed, that makes some people unhappy. But I think if you have to make people unhappy, that's the way to do it.
Well, Gary Sick, I thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Gary Sick, who's a senior research scholar at Columbia University's Middle East Institute and the author of All Fall Down, America's Tragic Encounter with Iran, and October Surprise, America's Hostages in Iran and the Election of Ronald Reagan. He served on the National Security Council under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan and was the principal White House aide for Iran during the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis. And we're going to take a brief station break and we'll look further into the agreement in which symbolism outweighs substance.
And it seems like, and it feels like, and it feels like a brand new day, a brand new day, yeah.
ای فدای آن همه عطر و بوی تو، هر زمان دل می کشد پر به سوی تو، هر کجا پا می نهم سر فرود آرم، قبله گاه من شده خاک کوی.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William O. Beeman, who's a professor and chair of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Minnesota and president of the Middle East section of the American Anthropological Association, best known as a Middle East specialist for more than 30 years. He has served as a consultant to the United States State Department, the Department of Defense, the United Nations, and the United States Congress. He is the author of 14 books, including Language, Status, and Power in Iran, The Great Satan Versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other, and his latest book is Iranian Performance Traditions. Welcome to Background Briefing, William O. Beeman.
Thank you very much. I'm so pleased to be with you.
And you have an article in the Huffington Post, the Iran Accord, profoundly and primarily symbolic. You argue that both sides, the U.S. and its partners appeared tough and got very little. Iran appeared tough and gave up very little. Both sides save face. This is essentially no one won and no one lost. So if indeed that this is more about symbolism than substance, where do you think the we'll start seeing results. If presumably symbolism, if it's more powerful than substance, eventually is going to lead to more substance, right?
Well, look, I'm an anthropologist, and as an anthropologist, I can tell you that I believe profoundly in the power of symbolism. It is one of the main driving forces in human behavior and in human life. And in this case, the symbolism is extremely important. We have very short memories in the United States. We forget that Iran already suspended its uranium enrichment as a show of good faith in 2004. In fact, from late 2003 till beginning of 2006. And this was in conjunction with negotiations that were taking place with the European powers and Iran. The United States absolutely refused to participate in these negotiations, and the fact that Iran had suspended its uranium enrichment was actually decried by President Bush as a cynical move and as meaningless and so forth. The thing that was different about those talks and the talks that took place in Geneva is that the United States wasn't present. And I think everybody knows that the principal difficulty in foreign relations with Iran is not with any of the European powers, it's with the United States. The European powers, all of them, continue to have embassies in Tehran. They all have ambassadors. They all have Iranian representation in their capitals. They never cut off diplomatic relations with Iran. It was only the United States. So to actually have in Geneva the United States sitting down across the table to have our Secretary of State talking to Iran's foreign minister in prolonged discussions, it was amazing, and it was something that had not taken place in 34 years. So whatever they agreed upon, even if they'd agreed that, that red is red and black is black and green is green, if they'd simply issued a statement of agreement about anything whatever, the fact that they agreed is actually almost more important than the substance of what they agreed to. Of course, both sides had domestic audiences that they had to placate. And so the United States had to seem like it was getting something out of Iran. Iran had to seem like it was getting something out of the United States. And indeed, both sides did get something. But quite honestly, what Iran gave up is something that was very easy for it to give up. And what the United States gave to Iran was actually to give back money that Iran already had. It was already their money, but it had just been frozen. And what the really important agreement here in these talks was the United States tacitly agreeing that Iran should be able, under the aegis of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, to continue to enrich uranium as part of its peaceful nuclear program. And this has been a point of contention in the United States. Wendy Sherman, for instance, before the Foreign Relations Committee in October this year, had said that the United States does not recognize the right to enrich as being specified in the non-proliferation treaty. But, in fact, President Ford, in 1975, explicitly said that Iran has the right to enrich. In fact, the United States supplied the means by which Iran could enrich uranium. So we have already broken that particular statement. That's water over the dam. And for us to claim that the United States never recognized that is wrong.
Again, I'm speaking with William O. Beeman, who's a professor and chair of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Minnesota and president of the Middle East section of the American Anthropological Association. Best known as a Middle East specialist for more than 30 years, he has served as a consultant to the United States State Department, the Department of Defense, the United Nations, and the United States Congress, and he's the author of 14 books, including Language, Status, and Power in Iran, The Great Satan versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other, and his latest book is Iranian Performance Traditions. Let's talk about your book, The Great Satan versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran demonize each other. As much as this is a breath of fresh air in this vexed relationship that's gone on for 34 years, it did start, after all, with the hostage taking. We just got through with talking with Gary Sick, who served on the National Security Council as the point man on that crisis. The perennial Great Satan, Death to America stuff, I think does, filter down into the heartland of America, and Americans just don't like that, you know.
Well, I don't want to repeat any. I'm sorry, I didn't hear what Gary Sick had to say. I mean, he obviously is one of our great experts on Iranian foreign relations and on American foreign relations with Iran. He was part of military intelligence for many, many, many years and sat on the National Security Council. And his book, All Fall Down, is an excellent and a very excellent introduction to the Iranian Revolution and its aftermath. But he probably told you that the story didn't start with the hostage crisis or even with the Iranian Revolution, but in modern times, the real problem started with the deposing of Prime Minister Mossadegh in 1952-1953. The United States at that time was afraid that Prime Minister Mossadegh was going to be weak and was not going to be able to resist Soviet influence, and also he had nationalized the Iranian oil company, which made the British and the United States mad. We had a new young Shah on the throne who was very irresolute and rather dissipated as a young fellow, and the public were supporting Mossadegh, and the Shah fled the country. The United States and the CIA engineered a coup, brought him back, and the hostage crisis was precipitated by the fact that the Shah, having left Iran during the revolution, was very sick, and no one knew it, and he came to the United States for treatment. And the Iranians were dismayed because they thought that the United States was going to do a repeat of what had happened with Mossadegh. And the Shah was in the United States to plot with the U.S. To overthrow the revolution and reinstate him on the throne. The United States didn't allow Iranian doctors to actually examine the Shah. And as a result, students occupied the U.S. embassy, and things got out of hand, and it lasted 444 days. So this was this is something that some American intelligence and political officials have never forgotten. They've never forgiven Iran for this, and despite the fact that we had a settlement, the Algiers Accords, in which, by the way, the United States agreed never to interfere in Iranian internal affairs again, the taint of the hostage crisis has remained, and people are still quite mad about it.
You know, I've never understood, William O. Beeman, why it was that Carter allowed the Shah in at the urging of Henry Kissinger.
It's a little hard to... Well, the Shah was our friend, and if you remember, just before the revolution, the Carters knew that the Shah was in trouble, and they actually traveled to Tehran spend New Year's Eve with the Shah in a very, very, kind of highly, again, symbolic show of support. Carter announced that he couldn't imagine anyone with whom he would rather spend New Year's Eve than the Shah and his wife. When push came to shove, he had announced to the world that the Shah was this great friend of the United States. And when the Shah was really sick with cancer, it became very, very difficult to refuse them entry to the States. They had refused them refuge from the revolution. The Shah went to Egypt, he went to Morocco, and it sort of all around the world. But it was when it was very clear that he was dying, that was when the Carter administration and Kissinger said, "Look, we can't really abandon this person." I mean, politics aside, he's been our friend and staunch supporter, and we really have to help him. As it turned out, it didn't help. He did die. But as I say, the Iranians knew nothing of his illness, absolutely nothing. So you can understand how they would think that the pattern of the 1950s, the Mossadegh pattern, was repeating itself.
Well, given this history, then, do you think, and it's clear that the hawks on both sides have dominated the narrative up until now, do you think the doves on both sides now will be able to establish an enduring dialogue?
You know, we have to understand that oftentimes serious political change never takes place until a generation, sometimes two generations, passes. Right now, the vast majority of Iranian citizens don't have any knowledge of the revolution. They don't have any knowledge of even Ayatollah Khomeini because the population is very young. And here in the United States, since I teach at a university, I can tell you that the American students that I teach, and even many, many young adults, have absolutely no knowledge of the Iranian Revolution or the hostage crisis. It's now part of their history books. And so their emotional attachment to these events is very, very shallow or doesn't exist at all. So the political climate in both countries is such that, you know, you now can talk about some kind of reconciliation with Iran. Even President Obama was just a kid when these things took place. So he has no personal stake or involvement in this.
Well, I think the fact that he's maybe a lame duck, I mean, he's still getting screamed at from the right. By the way, it's not entirely sure that the Congress is not going to try and scuttle this deal and that the president may have to veto legislation invoking even more sanctions. It's not entirely clear that the House won't and the Senate won't try and kill this deal, or the Republicans won't try and kill this deal.
You know, of course, the politicians will try to do anything, but one has to remember that the negotiations are taking place in the framework of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. And the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty is signed by 189 nations, including the United States, including Iran. It guarantees Iran the right to develop peaceful nuclear energy. And as I pointed out to you, the United States has already recognized that uranium enrichment is part of that peaceful nuclear energy development, no matter what Wendy Sherman or anybody else says today. We have a history of recognizing it, and every European nation also accepts that principle. So the United States, as signatory to the treaty, also has the responsibility of guaranteeing the rights of non-nuclear weapons nations to that peaceful energy development. So if the United States makes the demand that, for instance, Israel would like it to make, and that is to totally dismantle the Iranian nuclear program, we are violating the treaty. We are violating the conditions of the treaty. And I think our legislators are not they really don't seem to comprehend this. A treaty is a big thing. It requires a two-thirds vote of the Senate. With 189 other nations involved with the treaty, if Iran's rights are violated, then everybody's rights are under attack. So it is a very serious matter, and I think our lawmakers have to consider that particular situation. I realize there are many, many people in the U.S. Congress who really think that international treaties are just for the birds. You know, we should just scuttle them all and never have any international treaties that bind us to doing anything abroad. But frankly, if we're going to live in the world of nations, you can't live that way. That's really an impossibility.
Well, William Beaman, it's also always been quite counterintuitive on the part of the United States to make such an issue over the nuclear enrichment, because my understanding is that it's not so much the government of Iran that's drawing this red line. The Iranian people are very sympathetic to the idea that they should have the right. It's a form of national pride on their part. So the idea, I mean, the neocons aside, they just want war. But the more pragmatic foreign policy people will argue that, you know, you need to drive a wedge between the people and this government, this theocratic government. Well, you couldn't have chosen a worse issue to drive a wedge between the people and this Iranian government, because the people apparently support the idea of Iran's right to enrich uranium.
Yeah, they absolutely do. And, you know, and I think that I was listening to the last part of Gary Sick's discussion with you, and I think that there's no question in my mind that the nuclear issue was chosen by neoconservatives as a point that would be accepted by the people of the United States as a casus belli, a reasonable cause to attack Iran. Because what they really want is regime change. They don't like the Iranian regime. They don't like the Iranian government after the revolution. And so they'd very much like to see that government overthrown and replaced with somebody, with some people who would be more sympathetic to the United States, certainly less hostile toward Israel in their minds. And the nuclear issue is a, frankly, I think a pretext, because the nuclear industry in Iran is 40 years old, and it was started at the instigation of the United States. And Iran has been carrying forward with this program pretty much as it was originally designed in the 1970s. One of the points in the discussions was the research reactor in Arak, A-R-A-K, Arak, right?
Right.
This research reactor started to be designed in the 1980s, so we've known about it for almost 30 years, but it never became an issue until like last week. Frankly, the reactor it's well known. It's a heavy water reactor. It's designed to produce radioisotopes. It happens that one of the possibilities for the use of the spent fuel rods is to extract plutonium. But the plutonium can't be extracted from spent fuel rods unless you have a completely separate extraction plant. And Iran doesn't have such a facility. And furthermore, since Iran is a signatory to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, they're under inspection. Every single scrap and flake of fissile material in Iran is under the inspection of the International Atomic Energy Agency. This is what makes Iran different from, for instance, North Korea, who withdrew from the treaty, or from Pakistan or India, or frankly, from Israel. Israel has not a signatory to the treaty, and so therefore it has very little to say about anybody's treaty rights, because they haven't signed on.
Well, William Obiman, I thank you so much for joining us here. I appreciate it.
You're most welcome. You're most welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with William Obiman, who's a professor and chair of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Minnesota and president of the Middle East section of the American Anthropological Association, best known as a Middle East specialist for more than 30 years. He has served as a consultant to the United States State Department, the Department of Defense, the United Nations, and the United States Congress. He's the author of 14 books, including Language, Status, and Power in Iran, The Great Satan versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other. And his latest book is Iranian Performance Traditions. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the renewed tensions and divisions in Thailand that led to the military coup of 2006.
We are Siamese, if you please. We are Siamese, if you don't please. Now we're looking over our new Danwi style. If we like, we stay for maybe quite a while.
Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gerald Fry, a distinguished professor of international intercultural education at the University of Minnesota, previously a Peace Corps volunteer in Thailand. He has written extensively about Thailand and Southeast Asia and is currently working on a book called The Thais, the Bamboo, and the Lotus. He wrote the recently published definitive book on Thailand, A Historical Dictionary of Thailand. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gerald Fry.
Good evening. Thank you for inviting me. Again, we have some political turbulence in Thailand.
We do indeed, and it's certainly a lot more serious than that ridiculous Disney song that we just heard. Tell me, this does feel like the tensions that brought about the military coup in 2006 that led to the ouster of Thaksin is now being revived by his sister Yingluck, who is the current prime minister, and apparently what's prompted the yellow shirts, I guess the pro-Thaksin people are the red shirts, it's prompted the yellow shirts to come back onto the streets is the idea that Thaksin may be able to return from exile without serving a jail sentence for corruption, because he left the country in the middle of the trial for corruption, did he not?
Yes. So, well, he left the country to avoid any prosecution and possible even being put in jail for those criminal acts that the court found him guilty of. Although it's interesting, I would not characterize the protesters now as yellow shirts. I would say these protesters overlap with the yellow shirts, but they're not identified as yellow shirts, and they are primarily people who, from quite a wide range of groups, who were extremely upset with this amnesty bill that you mentioned. It was a blanket amnesty bill that would have, and the original conception was that it would be an act of reconciliation. Because everybody who had committed some kind of crime in the last 5 or 6 years related to politics would be basically not punished for that. And the Prime Minister Yingluck really miscalculated, and I'm sure her brother advising her miscalculated to try to move ahead with this amnesty bill. It obviously gave rise to a tremendous amount of resentment against this amnesty bill. So there were people who were not yellow shirts, but who really were very, extremely opposed to this blanket amnesty bill.
Well, isn't there a problem? Sorry.
But then the Senate actually, seeing what people were thinking about related to this law that was being proposed, this amnesty law, the Senate then turned it down. But then Suthep, the leader of this demonstration, wanted to keep going. So now his goal is to get rid of Yingluck.
And the prevailing feeling amongst those on the streets, although there have been counter demonstrations on the part of the red shirts who support Thaksin and his sister, the prevailing feeling is that the current prime minister, the sister, is taking orders from the brother in exile.
And that's certainly true, but we don't know exactly, unless you have privy access to all their communications, one doesn't know exactly what percent. Obviously, she's strongly influenced by her brother, and I would speculate, pure speculation, that her brother encouraged her to go ahead with this amnesty bill, and if he did, it was a very bad miscalculation, both on her part and his part. But there are as I said, many people who really were upset because of this amnesty law. And there were even red shirts who were upset with the amnesty law because it also meant that the people who authorized the crackdown in April and May of 2010 were also not to be punished.
Again, I'm speaking with Gerald Fry, a distinguished professor of international and intercultural education at the University of Minnesota, previously a Peace Corps volunteer in Thailand. He has written extensively about Thailand and Southeast Asia and is currently working on a book called The Thais, the Bamboo, and the Lotus. He wrote the recently published definitive book on Thailand, A Historical Dictionary of Thailand. Now, explain to us, if you can, Gerald Fry, the source of Thaksin's and the Red Shirts' support largely comes from the rural poor. So I don't understand how you could have a populist billionaire. This guy's a billionaire. He's like Rupert Murdoch, isn't he?
Oh, he's one of the richest, very rich, and his as a businessman was extremely successful, extremely wealthy. And that's one of the ironies of his being accused of corruption.
But how do you explain his grassroots populist support amongst the poor? I mean, how does a billionaire become a left-wing populist?
He had advisors who were very much involved in the student revolution of October 1973. And I think he realized, as John F. Kennedy was incredibly wealthy, I would compare him in that way to Kennedy, an incredibly wealthy politician in America who had this very sincere empathy for black people and worked hard to improve the civil rights situation. So Thaksin realized, and he's a smart politician. He's a very smart guy. I had about a 90-minute interview with him once. He's a very smart guy, and he realized that where the votes are in the northeast of Thailand and in the north. One-third of the electorate is in the northeast, and his two election wins are the biggest in Thai political history. And he was the only politician to ever win an outright majority in parliament.
And after he was ousted by the military, his sister got elected.
In each election since he was ousted by the military, his proxies have won the election because it's just the demographics. The South has a limited population, so the Democrats are strong in the South. The Democrats are strong in Bangkok. But the big population, so if majority rules, and that's democracy, then if Yingluck dissolved parliament, which I who knows what she will do, there's a no-confidence debate going on right now in the parliament against her, but she has the votes she should have the votes to make that unsuccessful. But they clearly have the votes. The Democrats do well in Bangkok, they do well in the South, but the most number of people voting are in the North and Northeast. And Thaksin's from the North, and Yingluck is from the North. Their mother tongue is actually a Lao dialect, and the people of the Northeast, many of them have as their mother tongue a Lao dialect.
So what is the role of the royal family, who are largely revered and play a much stronger role than, say, the British monarchy do?
They are apolitical, and they try to make though some Western scholars criticize them for being partisan. In fact, I think they really make a strong effort to be apolitical.
So they're not.
And then when the king speaks, he tries to speak on behalf of the people. So if he's concerned about some issue, then he speaks as kind of representing the people and bringing to the attention this concern that he has.
But they're
apolitical. They don't ostensibly get involved with any particular political party.
Well, I'm just thinking about what breaks the deadlock. You know, the military have intervened there on endless occasions, right, in recent Thai history.
But since they became a constitutional democracy in 1932, there probably have been 20 coup attempts during that time. So there have been many coup attempts. The last successful one was, as you pointed out, September 2006. The previous successful one was in there was a coup back in 1991, February of 91. So that's two in the last, 27 years, right?
Right. But
so they're less frequent. They're less frequent now. And the question would be, to what extent has Thaksin, with all his money, and Yingluck, have they actually, have key military leaders in their pocket, so to speak.
Right, but in the time between the ouster of Thaksin and him going into exile, his opponents occupied Bangkok's main airport, shutting it down in 2006. And then in 2010, Thaksin supporters and allies held street protests for 2 months that paralyzed Bangkok. So isn't that the portent that you have this strange paralysis that plays out in, with different sort of colored T-shirts and
I think it's a kind of and we saw this in the Philippines when People Power got rid of Marcos. We saw that in the Philippines when the People Power took care of that situation in the Philippines.
People Power backed by plutocrats, though.
So People Power in the Philippines resulted in a victory for the people, and Corazon Aquino being elected president of the Philippines. And I think obviously that was a good example of people power. In October 14, 1973, student power in Thailand led to a change in regime. The three military dictators were kicked out of power. In May of 1991, people power in Thailand resulted in General Sujinda being kicked out of power. And then the Yellow Shirts were very successful with their demonstrations leading up to the ouster of Thaksin. So I think the Thai people feel they have a certain, they're much more assertive than we are in the United States. You can't imagine the United States, people in the United States trying to, today in Thailand, Monday in Thailand, they occupied Suthep, the leader of this demonstration, ordered his people to occupy key ministries in Bangkok. So they moved into the Ministry of Finance. They moved into the several key ministries, Department of Public Relations, the Budget Bureau, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And those are illegal actions. So I think the seizure of the airport was an illegal action. So I think the Thais feel they have this potential for making a difference politically by demonstrating so strongly and then in this case going beyond the law and becoming doing illegal things, occupying these buildings.
Right. So this is not just say occupying Zuccotti Park in New York. This is serious. They're occupying government ministries and thousands and thousands taking to the street.
Can you imagine the United States protesters occupying Dulles Airport near Washington or Washington National, or the Yellow Shirts at one time occupied Government House?
Well, I for one would welcome that, frankly. But
this is, in a sense, it's extreme democracy without responsibility.
Right. Right. Well, it's better than apathy, I can tell you that.
It's not apathy. When I was teaching at Thammasat in the Peace Corps in the 60s, the Thais were really politically apathetic. Not anymore. Right. Not anymore. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. And then, of course, the Constitutional Court, Suthep, and the irony of this is that Suthep, the leader of this demonstration, was a deputy prime minister who was involved in the crackdown on the demonstrators in April and May of 2010. The very same man.
Well, General Fry, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for listening to my voice.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with General Fry. He's a distinguished professor of international and intercultural education at the University of Minnesota. Previously, he's a Peace Corps volunteer in Thailand. He's written extensively about Thailand and Southeast Asia and is currently working on a book called The Thais, the Bamboo, and the Lotus. And he wrote recently published the definitive book on Thailand, A Historical Dictionary of Thailand. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcast at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. Bye for now. I'm